The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
Okay, so let us continue. And this morning we had a look at how to deal with ill will and the other big defilement or the big problem that hinders progress in meditation practice is sensual desire, or just general attachment to the sensual objects of the world. And so this is what I'm going to have a look at next. And it's a bit different. Yeah, sensual pleasures are more difficult to overcome than ill will. Ill will is easy because we know it is unpleasant. It's very obvious why it is problematic. They're much more difficult to see with sensuality. So it's the approach is maybe a little bit different, although there are a lot of similarities as well. So with the sensual pleasures, I sometimes think it might be better to have like a global understanding rather than dealing with individual instances, which can be quite hard. Sometimes just kind of general reflections on why they are problematic can often be useful. And then gradually kind of the mind sort of moves in different direction as a consequence. You have less attachment to these things that also affects the kind of general desires as well. So this is what this sutta is about. There are also ways of dealing with kind of individual instances of these things arising. But anyway, this is my focus. My general focus is more on these kind of larger ways of thinking about this. So this is from a sutta known as the Potalia Sutta. Majjhima Nikaya, Middling Sayings, number 54. And this is a sutta which contains a number of similes on this particular topic. And these similes are also found elsewhere in the suttas. Often they are just named, they are just kind of referred to. They're not actually spelt out in full, but this sutta is where they are spelt out in full, and you get a full feeling for what they are like. And this is what is interesting about the suttas, is this kind of cross referencing that you find there, that similes are mentioned in one place but they're spelt out in full somewhere else, or the Four Noble Truths are mentioned but they're only spelt out somewhere else. So you can see how the suttas rely on each other for a full understanding of what is going on. It's like they're an integrated whole, where one aspect can only be understood in terms of other aspects or other suttas. You get this this idea that these are come from one mind of one person, because they all need to be understood in terms of each other. Anyway, so this is the Potalia Sutta, and this is this fellow called Potalia who meets the Buddha, and this is what happens when they meet. And as usual, this is how it starts. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the country of the Anguttarapana, where there was a town of theirs called Apana. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Apana for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Apana, and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went to a certain grove for the day's abiding. Having entered the grove, he sat down at the foot of a tree. So the day's abiding is like the meditation practice. Yeah, would be better to say that he entered after a meal, he went to the grove for the day's meditation, would be a better way of putting it. It's the Pali idiom, vihara or viharati, which literally means to dwell. It also refers to meditation practice in the suttas. Then Potalia, the householder, while walking and wandering for exercise, wearing the full dress with parasol and sandals, also went to the grove. And having entered the grove, he went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side, and the Blessed One said to him, "There are seats, householder. Sit down if you like." So, when this was said, the householder Potalia thought, "The recluse Gotama addresses me as householder," and angry and displeased, he remained silent. So, the idea here, you have this a fellow called Potalia, and he's wearing full dress with parasol and sandals. And the idea here is that he's a bit kind of haughty, yeah, a bit kind of arrogant, perhaps, or takes himself a bit too seriously. This is kind of the sort of thing that people in high society would use, yeah, parasols and sandals and dressing up properly and all of this. So you have to know how the suitors work to really understand what is going on here. So it's probably a little bit conceited, perhaps, yeah. And you can see here when the Buddha calls him householder, he gets upset because in his mind he has kind of given up the world, whereas he's still kind of wearing all the symbols of a householder, and even to a slightly excessive extent, even to the point of being a bit haughty or whatever you want to call it. So that is kind of the background there. And then a second time the Blessed One said to him, "There are seats, householder, sit down if you like." And a second time he thought again, the recluse Gotama is addressing me as householder, and angry and displeased, he remained silent. A third time the Blessed One said to him, again the same thing happens. But this time he says to the Buddha, "Master Gotama, it is neither fitting nor proper that you should address me as a householder." But householder, you have the aspects and marks and signs of a householder. "Nevertheless, Master Gotama, I have given up all my work and cut off all my affairs." In what way, householder, have you given up all your work and cut off all your affairs? "Master Gotama, I have given all my wealth, my grain, silver and gold, to my children as their inheritance. I do not advise or blame them about such matters, but merely live on food and clothing. That is how I have given up all my work and cut off all my affairs." Householder, the cutting off of affairs, as you describe it, is one thing, but in the Noble One's training, the cutting off of affairs is different. So the Noble One's training, this is the Arya Vinaya, Arya, the Noble Ones, in other words, this is referring to the Buddha, and the noble people, and discipline, Vinaya. Vinaya often means more like training than discipline, how you train yourself. This word discipline is a bit sort of has a bit negative connotations in the kind of modern society, so I don't really like it, and it doesn't really fit either. It is often Dhamma and Vinaya. Dhamma is the doctrine, and the Vinaya is the training that comes from that doctrine, how you train yourself. It includes rules and disciplines, but that's not really the main thing. The main thing is the training of the mind. So he says it's different, And of course, then Potalia says, "What is the cutting off of affairs like in the Noble One's training, Venerable Sir? It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma, showing what the cutting off of affairs is like in the Noble One's training." "Then listen, householder, and attend closely to what I shall say." So then comes this long sutta. I have kind of paired it back to the essential things I want to talk about. There's a lot more in there. And if you're interested, you can read the whole thing. You have the reference there now. But I want to talk specifically about how to deal with the essential pleasures. And that's why I've just cut out the rest of it. Otherwise, it just takes too long to go through everything here. So here come these similes of the Buddha. "Householder, suppose a dog, overcome by hunger and weakness, was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, a clean-hacked skeleton, or really a bone, of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by knowing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton or meatless bones smeared with blood? No, Venerable Sir, why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually, that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So the sensual pleasures are like a skeleton of meatless bones. Okay, doesn't sound too good, does it? First thing to understand here about the word sensual pleasures is that sensual pleasures is not always a very appropriate translation for this word. This word is kama, not kamma. Kamma is like action, but kama is these pleasures of the world, kama loka, kama vachara, the sphere of a sensuality. But really this word means two things. And the main meaning in the suttas is the sensual objects, yeah, the sensual things in the world. In other words, the things that we attach to, the things that you crave for. Yeah, this is the main meaning. So these are the things that are called a skeleton here, yeah, because it's like an object that you enjoy. So here, it actually the main reference is actually to the objects of the sensual realm. It can also refer to the desire, yeah, like the sensual desire, the desire for these objects. But the main thing, it actually is a reference to these objects. So what are these objects? And basically, these objects are pretty much everything in the world that you are attached to. Yeah, all attachments are really within that sensual realm. Yeah, it's very few things that are outside of that realm, unless you enter some deep meditation state or whatever. So it's a very broad category, the sensual realm. And it includes, you know, so much. And because everything that we know in this world pretty much is part of that realm. From the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, it's all just basically an endless stream of sensual impressions. Or I should say sensory impressions, because they come through the five senses. Sensual sounds like it is, a lot. It is kind of to do with defilements, and it doesn't always have to do with defilements. Often it just that's part of the aspect of what we comes through the five senses. So they are sensory objects rather than sensual objects necessarily. And even at night you dream about these things. It's a very constant immersion. We are immersed in this world, and we don't really know what it is like to emerge from that world. It is very rare for people to emerge, to kind of get that bird's eye view, to remove themselves from that world and actually see what is going on. So we are all a bit like the fish or the tadpole in water. We don't really know what the world we are in is like, because we've never really been outside. And a very important part of the Buddhist path is actually to withdraw from that world to understand what it really is like. You can only understand that when you become, instead of being a tadpole, you become a frog. Yeah, so the part of the our job is to become a frog. You ready to become a frog? Yeah? It's quite nice to be a frog. You can jump around. Yeah, dry land. Yay, dry land. Dry land is like samadhi. That's samadhi. It's dry land. You see the metaphor here. You come out of the water for the first time. But you get the idea. Yeah, you have to emerge from something. If you are within something all the time, you don't even know what it is. It's impossible to know what it is without emerging from it. So it kind of makes sense. So this dog, yeah, overcome by hunger and weakness, it means it is full of craving. That's really what it means. If you're hungry, you know what it's like when you're really hungry. You're desperate to eat. Yeah, it is. You have a lot of craving for food. So this is this dog, yeah? And then you're waiting outside the butcher shop. You're kind of waiting for the food to arrive so you can kind of satisfy that craving. So the craving can be in any realm. You just in any five of the five senses, and you're waiting to find some kind of satisfaction to still the craving. Yeah, this is the problem here. And then when eventually you're going to still the craving, what do you get? You get a skeleton. Instead of getting some proper meat, yeah, you get a skeleton with a bit of blood on it. Is that going to satisfy you? There's no way. In fact, the problem is that it's not only is it not going to satisfy this poor dog, but the dog gets a little bit of the taste of the meat. The blood tastes a bit like meat. So you get this feeling that now I know what meat is like. You get this idea that you might know what it feels like to be really satisfied, but you don't get satisfied. All you get is more craving because you get the taste for it, but you don't feel the satisfaction. So the dog, poor dog, you know, licks the bone a little bit and gnaws on this bone, crunching away, doesn't really get any satisfaction. And after a while, it understands there's nothing here. It runs off to the next butcher shop, does the same thing. Yeah, standing outside the next butcher shop. Same thing happens again. And then it keeps on, carries on like this from butcher shop to butcher shop. And the penny never drops that butchers don't give good meat to dogs. Yeah, the good meat is not meant for dogs, meant for sale, for, you know, to make a profit for that butcher. Dogs don't get it, especially in the simile. All the butchers are equally stingy. No butcher, in the real life, there might be a nice butcher who might give some meat to a dog, yeah? But in the simile, there's no such nice person. They're all really nasty characters, and there's no way they're going to give anything to the dog. So you can see how terrible it is. Yeah, and then the dog dies, yeah, after running from butcher shop to butcher shop to butcher shop, dies, it gets reborn in your next life, and because the hunger was never stilled, you continue in exactly the same way. It's kind of desperate, isn't it? It's really sort of terrible. And this is, according to the Buddha, what sensual objects in the world are like. There is no stilling in that realm. There is no real satisfaction. And even the satisfactions we get, they're often quite hollow in the sensual realm. You have a good meal, you sort of enjoy it, and afterwards you feel really tired, you want to go to bed. Yeah, that's kind of the satisfaction. And then you carry on, and it doesn't take long before the hunger comes back again. There is no real contentment there. There's just more craving down the track. It carries on and on endlessly. And while you are in the middle of trying to satisfy and to be content with the sensual pleasures, you die. And then you get reborn again, and then straight away you carry on in the same way, just like this dog in the simile. It's kind of despairing once you start to see this. And the reason why it is like this is because we are trying to satisfy. There's a psychological problem, that emptiness inside, the craving inside of us, the mind that isn't content and satisfied, it cannot be satisfied by external things. External things can do a little bit for you. They might kind of temporarily dampen down the hollowness inside, but the hollowness will always return. As soon as that object is gone, and we need something else to satisfy that hollowness. You cannot fill up the inner vacuum by external things. It's just obvious when you think about it. So then, once you get that, that the problem is a psychological one, it's a mental one. That's where you have to act. That's what you have to do something with. So your strategy changes. Instead of then trying to use external phenomena, external happinesses, external pleasures to fill up the inner void, if you like. Yeah, this sense of something lacking. That's why we always run after things and try to fill it up with external things, because something is missing inside. Instead of doing that, you turn your attention in a different direction. The Buddha comes along and says, wait a minute, you're looking in the wrong place. Don't look in the wrong place, look in the right place. Yeah? So look in the right place. The Buddha says, if you live with kindness, if you live a life of generosity, if you live a life of friendliness and compassion towards other people, if you have a degree of peace, then what you do, you start to build up an inner contentment and happiness that comes from living well. And gradually that inner contentment and happiness, as it builds up, it's of a very different kind than the happiness you get from external objects. The external objects, they are there for a while, then they disappear, and the old craving comes back, maybe even more strongly than before. But the inner happiness that you have, they actually reduce that sense of there being a hole inside of you. They reduce that itch, yeah, which is always there, running after new things. So the psychological problem is starting to be resolved. Slowly, 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 you feel more complete as a person. And this is what we're looking for, that sense of completeness, where you don't have to run after things anymore, where you feel content as it is. And as you practice the spiritual path, starting with the simple things, actually it's not that simple, yeah? Even being kind all the time is challenging. But if you're able to do that in the right way, then go to the mind, think in the right way. And then eventually, as all of these aspects of morality come together, then you sit down in your meditation practice. And then one day you start to feel really peaceful. Yeah, and you know that when you start to feel really peaceful, you feel very content. It is as if you are moving towards real meaning, real purpose. It's as if you are starting to find that thing that you were looking for all the time via craving. Craving could never deliver, but now you're starting to get there. It's like magic, yeah? Instead of running around in the world, you sit down and watch your breath. The breath gives you the answer to all those things you're always looking for. It's like a miracle almost, except that in Buddhism we don't have miracles, but otherwise, you know, it's like really kind of marvelous and astonishing. And then the happiness and joy starts to build up inside. The more powerful that joy becomes, then combined with tranquility, you start to understand after a while that mind doesn't want to move anymore because it's so content with what is there. Everything you were looking for starts to arise in your psychology within. The deeper it becomes, the more powerful this inner contentment and satisfaction becomes, the less interested you are in doing anything in the external world, because now you're actually finding everything. And eventually, one day you enter a state of samadhi where there's absolute stillness. There's no more movement at all. You feel fully satisfied and content for the first time in your life. And because you're fully satisfied and content, there is no drive. There's nothing there to take you outside, to take you anywhere. Craving is gone, completely gone. You're absolutely still and absolutely content. And when there is nothing more to be done, that is what it means to find the meaning of life. Yeah, why? Because there's nothing more to do. You just sit there and you're perfectly content. The inner itch has disappeared. You feel complete. You feel satisfied for the first time in your life. That is what samadhi does. It gives you that feeling of meaning, of purpose, of having fulfilled the goal. But the meaning of life, in a sense, has been fulfilled at that particular point, because there is no more movement to go anywhere. There's no need to go anywhere else. So the weird thing, the thing that we kind of always have been looking for in the wrong place, via craving, via always pursuing the things in the world, we thought they were going to give that satisfaction, but they were not. And then one day we turn inward instead, and we find precisely the thing that we were looking for all along. Yeah, it's kind of, when you think about it, it's sort of obvious. But actually, it takes a Buddha to remind us that this actually is the truth. Yeah, this is the astonishing thing. Actually, it doesn't really take a Buddha, because samadhi can be had also in other teachings. Yeah, there are mystics in all sort of traditions. This still is a long way on the way towards enlightenment. But it's not enough, because in the end, that samadhi too is not really sustainable. Yeah, so that's why we also go beyond the insight, which is the real Buddha's teachings about non-self. And then in this way, you make that state, you make this, you create permanence in that happiness, and you don't really have to run back to these sensual pleasures anymore. So this is how the Buddha looks at sensuality. And to be able to understand this, the only way you can really understand this is to kind of withdraw from that sensual world, to see them from above, and then find that satisfaction inside where you are completely content. And this is why the Buddhist teachings are about the meaning of life. Everything in our life is this search that we're searching, looking through craving, trying to find an answer to this question, how we can kind of feel complete and don't have to run after things anymore. And the Buddha has the answer. And that is why it is the answer to the very meaning of life itself. Kind of astonishing when you think about it that way, because it means that everyone should be a Buddhist. Is that right? I think so. Why not be a Buddhist? If Buddhism gives you the meaning of life, yeah, maybe not Buddhism, but the Dhamma of the Buddha anyway, gives you the meaning of life, then it makes sense to be a Buddhist. It's not necessarily, it's hard to find the meaning of life, so if someone has discovered it, then... Anyway, that's what I say. But some people would no doubt disagree with that, but anyway, that still. Let's go on to the next one here. Householder, suppose a vulture, a heron, or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away, and then other vulture, herons, and hawks pursued it and pecked it and clawed it. What do you think, householder, if that vulture, heron, or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Or death-like suffering is a better translation, because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, household, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So this here obviously is about the how we always are fighting over sensual pleasures of the world, how we're always in competition over the things in the world. There is only so many, so much. The pie is only so large. Yeah, you only get certain slice, and we always want a larger slice. Someone else may have to have a smaller slice, and then if someone else thinks that you are taking part of their slice, then you have a problem, and you're going to end up likely fighting for it, and you're going to it's going to be very unpleasant. So this is what this simile is about. Everyone is trying to get more of the sensual realm, and sometimes it means that you end up fighting in this way. And this is, I think, a very interesting point about the sensuality, is that because it is an aspect of the external world around us, because we always want the same things, yeah, everybody wants more of the sensual realm, because craving is never satisfied, because of that, it is inherently problematic. It inherently leads to conflict, to arguments, to wars, to all of these kind of things, yeah? That is the problem with the one of the big problems with the sensual realm. You always want more, and because of that, it leads to conflict all the time. Yeah, and you know that that is true. You know, we looking for the same people to have as partners in life. Yeah, we argue about that, and we kind of fight over that, or whatever it is. We inheritances and promotions and money and just the kind of ordinary things in daily life. Whatever it is, and like when I sit next to Ajahn Nisarana, we fight over that last piece of cake. Is that right, Ajahn Nisarana? No, we don't actually do that. We have gone beyond that sort of thing, fortunately. But this is what sometimes happens, yeah. And you get something, someone else does not get it. So this is the problem in this world. There's always going to be competition. By definition, the sensual realm is unsatisfactory in this way. It must lead to aggression and problems, and that is kind of terrible. Yeah, there is no stability in that realm. There is no place of final peace where everyone lives together in harmony. It's impossible in that realm. Craving is a thing that distorts everything and makes that realm so unpleasant. A lot of the wars in the world are fought in the name of sensual pleasures, yeah, trying to control resources and things. A lot of it is about that. So from the largest conflicts to the smallest interpersonal conflict, and everything in between has to do with this realm of sensual pleasures. A lot of the insecurity and anxiety that we have is also about that, yeah? Finally, you find a nice partner in your life, someone you can live with, and then you get anxious they're going to leave you. Yeah, isn't that how it works? I can barely remember now. It's such a long time since I were engaged with this kind of stuff, but yeah, but that's how it works. It's obvious that's how it works, you know. So there is that endless problem in that particular realm, endless kind of things. And the Buddha describes this quite nicely in the suttas. He shows you, this is found in the Mahanidana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya number 15, where he shows you start out with craving, and then that craving leads to you try to acquire things, yeah, and then he shows all the steps of acquiring things, and eventually when you have acquired it, then you hold on to it. This is mine, and you kind of put it aside, and then you kind of that because you hold it, but then the kings and the robbers and the heirs and everyone else also wants it, then you fight and you have aggression and problems and conflict and all of these kind of things arising from that. This is, I don't know about you, but this to me is very kind of dispiriting about this realm, this of sensuality, that it is so inherently problematic, and it kind of makes it very off-putting to my mind. But of course, if you do the opposite, if you lead the spiritual life instead, that is very different, because the spiritual life is within us. But there's no, we can't fight over the inner life of each one of us. I want to, please give me part of your inner life. I'll take it from you. You can't do that. So the inner life is kind of something separate from other people. And because of that, you're building up these inequalities. Each one of us has to do that alone. Yeah, so there is no conflict in the realm of spirituality. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Because if you do build up your own inequalities, you are also, by the nature of those qualities, also building up harmony in the world at the same time. So it goes in the exact opposite direction. Spiritual qualities lead to more harmony, less conflict, less wars, less problems. coronavirus. Conflict. So, well, we have to be careful these days. So it's very different, yeah? It is a completely different way of thinking about life. It leads to a very, very different result. And this is the power of the spiritual path, that it actually has that sort of outcome, instead of the outcome of always being in conflict about things. So in that way, it is very, very useful. It's kind of despairing, yeah? You know from this that the world is never going to be peaceful. It's always going to be problematic. The root of the defilements of the mind is not really ill will. The root problem is always sensuality. That's the root problem. If you look at the five hindrances, it always starts with kama chanda, or it's also called loke abhijja. It's basically the synonyms, and they refer to the sensual desires of the world. That's the first one, and that is the main problem, because sensual desire always leads then to ill will. It leads to sloth, you know, tiredness and lethargy. It leads to restlessness and all of these things. Doubt, well, that's a little bit different. But if you have a lot of desire, you also will have doubt as well. So it's the root defilement really is the sensual pleasures, and it leads to all the other ones. You can reduce ill will a lot, but you can never eliminate it completely without also eliminating or reducing sensual desire at the same time. They're very closely hand in hand. And that's it's a useful thing to remember. Yeah, the hierarchy of these defilements, sensual desire being at the top, it comes back to that. The less satisfaction we find in that area, the better off we are, because then everything else tends to kind of fade away at the same time as a consequence of that. There are other reasons for fighting as well. We don't just fight because of sensual pleasures. Our sense of identity is also involved. If people challenge your identity, you see one of the really sad things is some of the things we see sometimes in Buddhist countries, like, you know, in Burma, where you have the Rohingyas and the Buddhists. You can see how some of the Buddhists really, in my opinion, really misunderstand what Buddhism is about. They talk about the Rohingyas challenging us as Buddhists, challenging the Buddhist religion. In other words, they take it as an identity thing, yeah? And now the Rohingyas are challenging our identity, and for that reason, we need to fight back. And then they come up with ideas such as using violence to fight back against these Muslim, basically these very poor Muslim people, yeah, who are in a really kind of difficult situation already. Then because of that, they act in very inappropriate ways, which in the long run will destroy Buddhism. If you want to destroy Buddhism, the best way is to make everyone disillusioned about Buddhism. Yeah, we all thought Buddhism was great until we saw how Buddhists actually behave in the world. And then it really is very destructive. It is through your behavior that eventually you inspire others, not by some kind of, identity thing like that. So identity also leads to conflict. But that is in many ways one step deeper, or maybe not. It depends on what kind of identity we're talking about. But that is also part of it. But sensual pleasure is a very big part of it. So these two things are the two things that often lead to conflict in the world. This is one of the things I was talked about recently when it comes to identity. Much better to identify with someone who has a good heart rather than identify with being a Buddhist. Or make what it means to be a Buddhist, to have a good heart, to be a good person. And then you can't really go wrong, because then you're going to practice in accordance with the Buddhist teachings. Make that your identity. Yeah, the sense of living well, living in the right way. Next one. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder? If that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or death-like suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and despair, while the danger in them is great. So sensual pleasures are like a grass torch, and then you go against the wind with a grass torch, not a good idea. So what does, well, a grass torch, well, it provides you with a little bit of happiness because you can see in the dark, yeah? So a little bit of happiness, but then it doesn't take long before kind of you catch fire if you kind of carry that grass torch against the wind. And sensual pleasures are like that. When you pick up a sensual pleasure, yeah, this has only water in it. I'm not sure if water is considered sensual pleasure, but anyway, I'll pretend it is. Just for the sake of kind of, so you pick up the sensual pleasures, yeah, and then as soon as you pick them up, you tend to attach to them, and that is the problem. So they provide a little bit of satisfaction straight away. Then, because of that happiness, then you attach to them. Yeah, this is kind of the nature of something that provides you with happiness. You go to a nice restaurant and think, wow, that was a really nice food. And then you go back to that restaurant in the future. And when that restaurant burns down, then you feel really, well, it's not too bad. You can probably deal with that. But still, you feel a bit sad because that nice restaurant, it burned down. That's a kind of minor sense of attachment. But you get the idea. As soon as you pick something up, you're making yourself vulnerable because that attachment will then lead you to suffering when that thing eventually has to go. Yeah, everything you pick up is impermanent by its very nature. Eventually, it will have to disappear. So every time you attach to something, you're asking for suffering. You're saying, please, may I suffer. And then that is exactly what happens. So that is the simile of the grass torch. Remember that these are my ideas of these similes. And no doubt they can be explained in different ways. But this is one way that this is the way I usually translate or understand these similes in this particular fashion. I'm not sure what else to say about that simile. So let's go on to the next one. Householder, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or death-like suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So this is a very interesting simile, yeah? Sensual pleasures are like, or sensual objects are like a charcoal pit. What do you think? Yeah? Does that make sense? It's a difficult one to see, isn't it? How can sensual pleasures be a charcoal pit? We're just enjoying ourselves, eating some nice food, having nice relationships or whatever. How can this have anything to do with a charcoal pit? Does it make any sense? It's very hard to really understand this. So it's a very powerful and strong simile. And what you have to do here, really, with these kind of similes, really it comes back to a degree of confidence and faith in the Buddha's teachings. It's very hard to really grasp this fully. Maybe you can understand it to some extent, but the full force of this is very hard to really grasp. But one of the ways, you know, the Buddha, when he says that what the Aryas take to be happiness, no ordinary people take to be suffering, and what the ordinary people take to be happiness, the Aryas think of as suffering. So the ordinary people take to be happiness is usually sensual pleasures. And the Aryas, they see it as suffering. So this is kind of where you have to come from. Here you have to come from a degree of confidence that the Buddha knew what he was talking about, and other people perhaps as well know that they are talking about. And then you can kind of gradually sort of move towards understanding this kind of thing here. So it is a bit like being, you know, if someone told you, here is a nice BMW, would you kind of twist your body this way and that to get away from that BMW? No, keep that BMW away. Don't get me near that BMW. But it's a very nice one. Look at this brand new one. It's a really expensive car. It's really got all these fancy things. And it even goes with batteries, so it's even environmentally friendly. Yeah, BMW. No, keep it away here. Yeah, charcoal pit. So this is what it means, yeah, really. And this is kind of why it is really hard to see here. So how can we approach this? And the way to approach this, and this is another sutta, which often I read out in connection with this, is Majjhima Nikaya 75, known as the Magandhya Sutta. And there's this fellow, he's also an ascetic, supposed to be an ascetic, but he indulges in sensual pleasures. In ancient India, they had all kinds of strange ascetics. One of them was this fellow who indulges in sensual pleasures. Sensual pleasures is the highest happiness, something like that. Would have been very attractive kind of asceticism, wouldn't it? Maybe asceticism is the wrong word if you indulge in sensual pleasure, but some kind of wanderer, yeah. And then he has this discussion with the Buddha, and he says to the Buddha, yeah, sensual pleasure, this is the highest happiness. And the Buddha says, well, you know, maybe not. Maybe there's an alternative way of looking at this. And the Buddha gives him this simile of the leper. Yeah, you know the leprosy, yeah, this kind of disease where you kind of have sores on your body and it gets really bad and it's very itchy and it's really terrible, and it still exists in the world today, but it doesn't exist in Australia, but certain places in the world, I think there are places in India where it still exists and certain other places as well. And it's very, very kind of bad illness. And so the Buddha says to Magandhya, well, suppose there is a leper, and this leper, you know, having all these sores over his hands and feet, he goes to the fire. He goes to a charcoal pit, just like this one here. And then he puts his hands out over the charcoal pit to burn, literally, you know, cauterize, it says in this particular sutta, but kind of to burn your hands over the fire. Yeah? And then that's what lepers do, because the itch is so bad, it actually feels nice to burn your hands. Yeah? And then the Buddha says to this man, Magandhya, he says, well, if this leper, if he comes across a doctor who can cure him of that leprosy, and then is very happy because he's cured of leprosy, would that man go back to that charcoal pit and still burn his hands over that charcoal pit? And Magandhya says, no. Why not? Well, because previously, when he was a leper, his faculties were distorted. What actually is painful feels as pleasurable. Why? Because your faculties are distorted. In other words, he just doesn't have a right perception of what is going on. That flame has always been painful, but beforehand he actually perceived what was painful as happiness because of the distortion of the faculties. That is the kind of the Buddha's answer to this thing here. And this is why it is so hard to understand. And one way of thinking about this that I have often thought about is a bit similar to maybe smoking cigarettes. I don't know if anyone of you have smoked cigarettes before, but I occasionally smoked cigarettes when I was young and silly. And we have all been young and silly. I'm not the only one, I hope. I guess very embarrassing if I'm the only one. But so. When you're young, you got to be cool, right? So you do things to kind of be one of the boys or whatever. So occasionally I would smoke cigarettes and even cigars and that kind of stuff, and it was just terrible. It was absolutely the most awful thing, and I would cough, and I wouldn't cough in front of my mates. I would just cough kind of behind the scenes afterwards. Yeah, but but it's really hard when you start, first time you smoke, absolutely terrible. But then you get addicted to it. And the weird thing, once you are addicted, I was never addicted to it, I just did it very occasionally. But once you are addicted to it, it is so nice. Not only is it nice, you're desperate to get your hands on a cigarette. Oh, you kind of fumble around and you get your cigarette out, you're all shaky, and you kind of get this cigarette, light your cigarette. So what originally was really bad, really terrible, suddenly it becomes like one of those incredible pleasures. Yeah, you have to have that cigarette. Has the taste of the cigarette changed? No, it still is the same taste. It's still, objectively, it still is really bad. But the reason why it tastes nice, because the craving is so incredibly strong. And the purpose of lighting the cigarette is not to actually enjoy the cigarette, it's to still the craving. Yeah, because the craving is so bad. So you are building up this artificial craving that then you are stilling. So you are creating an artificial kind of situation that you then still through smoking the cigarette, and then you feel a degree of happiness. Because why? Because you are stilling the craving. But there's no real happiness there in the first place. This is how it kind of works. It's kind of crazy. So I think one of the main things that this kind of simile refers to, is sexuality. Yeah, this is in that realm that you have a similar kind of craving here. What can be sometimes be very strong and very problematic. And then by giving up that craving, that by overcoming the craving, that is a very large part of the pleasure. I'm not saying it is all, but I think it's a very large part of it. And that's why once you become a Buddha or an Arahant, all craving is gone, there's no tanha, then of course you are beyond all of these things and it doesn't happen anymore. So there you are, that is the simile of the charcoal pit. So next time you see something really nice in the sensual realm, remember charcoal pit, and see if that works. It's like a mantra you can use. Okay, so let's go on to the next simile. Householder, suppose a man dreamt of lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Yeah, it's like when you have the craving for some sensual pleasure, then it all looks so lovely and beautiful, and you're really kind of, you know, you're kind of working hard to get it all sorted out, whatever it is, whether it's a relationship or a new something, a new house or whatever it is, or just a meal or whatever. And it, in your dreams, it looks so wonderful, but the reality never matches up to the dreams. It never gives the kind of satisfaction you want. It lasts very short. It is the dream is always a lie. So remember that. When you start thinking and dreaming about these things, the craving is very much a dream. Yeah, part of the craving is this dream about the future, what it is going to like. It is a lie. It never lives up to what it actually tells you that it's going to be. It's very obvious. You think back on your life, and you think back of all the dreams that you had as when you were young. You know, went to university and you studied this and that. And you know, I studied probably way too much. You know, became a monk. It's pretty useless to have studied for all those years. I should have just kind of, you know, dumped out of high school and never really kind of done anything more. So when you go to university, you think you're doing really well, and you kind of think about the future, you're going to have a job like this and do that, and this kind of girlfriend, and life is going to take this kind of shape. But of course, you end up becoming a monk instead. So it kind of takes a very different kind of path than what you think is going to do. And life is often like that. Those dreams are, even if you do end up living a more ordinary life, you don't become a monk, still, those dreams never turn out the way you think they're going to be. And sometimes we forget about our earlier dreams and we forget that it doesn't turn out like that. And that is part of the problem. If we remembered what it was like, then we would have been more careful with avoiding those silly dreams again in the future. It never turns out the way you think it will. That's part of the problem. Okay. Next one. Householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage, fine jeweled earrings, and preceded and surrounded by those borrowed goods, he went to the marketplace. And people seeing him would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual objects have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So in this example, you can see why sensual objects or sensory object is a much better translation than sensual pleasure, because it kind of makes much better sense in this context. So sensual pleasures are like borrowed goods, yeah? And so I find this reflection very useful, because we feel like we own things in the world. It feels like this is mine, yeah? That's why we get upset when people try to take it from us, or nature tries to kind of, claim back its own or whatever. Yeah, you see people here in Australia, quite regularly have houses burning down, and people get very distressed when their house is burned down, as is natural, because everything they thought they owned, suddenly it is all gone and disappeared. And people get really, really distressed because your house is where probably you have almost everything you own is probably collected in that house, and now everything is gone. So this is very very problematic, all these things in the world. So when you remember that everything we own really is borrowed, you have it for a certain amount of time and then it's gone. At the very latest, it will be gone when you die. You actually start to think about things in a very different way. And the one way of thinking about this is to imagine the difference between a car that is yours and a car that you rent. Yeah, the feeling is quite different. Yeah, the way you relate to that borrowed or rented car is very different from the way you relate to a car that you... Do you own it or do you just think you own it? You think you own it. It's not really yours. It is yours for a while and then it's gone again. So we need to... I think it's useful to sometimes think about life as more borrowed things. The life is full of borrowed stuff. And when you think about everything like that, then you start... Your relationship to all the things in the world start to change. Your relationships are borrowed, yeah? All your acquaintances are borrowed. Everything you own in this world is borrowed. Your body is borrowed. You have this body for a while, then it is gone. Yeah, and then you think differently. And you start to place less interest, less stock in those things, because you know they're going to go one day. And then you change again your values, and your values instead move towards those things that you actually do own. And the Buddha says there's one thing that we own, says the Buddha. Our kamma, exactly. Kamma, you own. The Buddha says we are the heir to our kamma. We are the owners of our kamma. It's the only thing the Buddha says we own in the world is our kamma. So you look at that. So how do you build up your good kamma? Well, basically, you build up the happiness inside, the stillness, the peace, all the good qualities. You build those up by living well and living in a wise way. That's how you build up your kamma. So you build up that thing which you know is going to go with you from one life to the next one, and very often carrying on for a long time into the future. Ultimately, you don't really own your kamma either. Ultimately, even that runs out, but it's much more like something you own than the things of the world. So you change your attitude. You become a long-term investor rather than a short-term investor. Yeah, in Buddhism, it's the only place where we invest for future lives. None of these... banks that you go to or investment banks talk about future lives. Actually, that's a business opportunity. Okay. Open up a bank, you just say, give to me, and you just get back automatically. Yeah, just give me all everything you got. Is that a good idea? That's an easy way of making money. Maybe that won't work. Maybe you have to do it differently. I don't know. So something like that. I think there might be a business. I'm not going to go down that track. So this is a very useful perception, because it shows you the shortcomings of everything around you in the world and how useless it is at the end of the day. At the end of the day, there's something else that matters more. Build up your inner good qualities, yeah? Build up those, because these are the things that will carry with you. Your values change, your outlook changes. This is very much part of the idea of right view, yeah? Because this really changes how you live your life. Let's come to the last one of the similes. Householder, suppose there were a dense grove not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none, none of his fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit. And he entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Then he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree, so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. Then a second man came, needing food, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit. And taking a sharp axe, he too entered that grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb a tree, so let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. What do you think, householder, if that first man who had climbed the tree doesn't come down quickly, when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or his foot or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or death-like suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you have this fellow who climbs the tree, yeah? And then he gets up into the tree, and it is a mango tree. The commentary says that. Yeah, this is my commentary. Yeah, says that there's a mango tree. So we're all allowed to write new commentaries. And so this is a new commentary. It's a mango tree. And the mangoes are just super duper, just exactly right. Neither overripe nor underripe. They're just ripe. And if you get a really nice mango, then you get, what happens then? And you eat it and you're really hungry, you get intoxicated, yeah? Intoxicated with the sensual pleasures. And so many things in life are intoxicating. Yeah? We often talk about being intoxicated by drugs and alcohol. But from a Buddhist point of view, you can be intoxicated by so much. And sensual pleasures is one of those things. You go around enjoying yourself and thinking that this is what it's all about. And you lose your clarity because of that intoxication. This is what happens in the world. And then because you are intoxicated, you forget the danger. And when you forget the danger, you start misconducting yourself because you forget about what really matters in life. If sensuality is everything, then whatever gets in the way of your enjoyment of sensual pleasures, you push it out of the way, often with ill will and often with all kind of bad things. And then you create bad karma as a consequence. If sensual pleasures mean too much, that's exactly what happens, yeah? And we see people do this all the time in the world. Unless you regain your mindfulness, unless you remember that there is a problem here, yeah, eventually you just die in the middle of all this. And then you fall out of that mango tree because someone else just chops it down. Who is that someone else who chops it down? It's just nature. Nature comes along and, you know, pulls out that tree by the root or whatever, and you fall over and then you die. And then because you have been foolish, you end up going maybe even to a bad destination in the future because you have really been misconducting yourself in a bad way. This is the problem. Yeah, this intoxication, sitting in the top of the tree, not really knowing what you're doing. So you wander around this grove. This grove is like samsara. It is a sensual realm. Wandering around in this dense grove, you never see far ahead of you, never see very far to the side. And you're looking around for sensual pleasures, looking around for the mango trees of life. The mango trees are all the beautiful pleasures in the world that we're looking for. And then one day, what happens? One day you move along in this jungle and you come to a hill, a little mountain in the middle of the forest. This is a simile found in the Majjhima Nikaya 125. And then you climb up that mountain. And when you climb up the mountain, what you see is you see this view and you look out. And when you look out, you see all the fields, you see all the villages, you see all the paths, you see all the rivers. You get an overview of the world, of what is going on. And then when you stand on top of the mountain, you shout down to your friend. You said, your friend at the bottom of the mountain, you say, you wouldn't believe this. If you come up here, you can see all this stuff. You really understand what is going on. And the friend says, nah, rubbish. There's no way you can see what's going on from the mountaintop. Yeah, absolute nonsense. I'm not going to come up with you. It's too hard work to kind of sit down with your legs crossed and watch your breath. So I'm not going to go to the mountaintop. And then, of course, the guy on that fellow on the top, he gets a bit exasperated because it's bleeding obvious. I can look out. I can see all these things. So he goes down to the bottom. This is the Buddha, and he grabs you by the arm. That's what the Buddha does. He grabs you by the arm. This is like he brainwashes you. It's like grabbing you by the arm, yeah? And then he pulls you up to that mountaintop. And then he says, well, what do you see? Oh, yeah, I see villages and, you know, fields. Yeah, feels a bit sheepish because he understands he was completely wrong before. And, well, why didn't you, you know, why did you say just before at the bottom of the mountain that there was no such thing? The reason was because I was hindered by these five hindrances. Primary among those five hindrances is the hindrance of sensuality. I couldn't see what was going on. I was stuck in the jungle of the world. I needed to elevate myself above that jungle, come up to the mountaintop before I could really understand the landscape. Then when I understand the landscape, I can understand the limits of sensual pleasures. I can understand why they are problematic. I can understand the inherent suffering that comes with sensual pleasures. All the problems, all the craving, all the charcoal pits of the world, you can understand for the first time. Yeah, and then now I understand what you're talking about. So this is the thing, yeah? This is what we're trying to do in Buddhism. When you cross your legs, you're actually trying to rise above the jungle of sensual pleasures and bring yourself up to this mountaintop to get the bird's eye view so you can actually understand what is going on. That is what meditation is about. And as you extract yourself from that sensual realm, only then do you become like the frog. Finally, the tadpole becomes a frog, yeah? You jump out of the water, you look down, and now you can understand why there was a problem to begin with. And this is why people are stuck in the sensual world, because it's very hard to understand that these things can exist as long as you are in that sensual world, because delusion deludes. You are so deluded, you are so stuck in that thing, the sensual world is so sticky, it is very difficult to understand that it's possible to emerge from that and find a state, a quality, a way of existence that is far, far more satisfactory than the ordinary existence in the sensual world. So that is that simile, yeah, it's kind of added with my commentary to it, yeah, so make, yeah, so these similes are very powerful, and each one of them, they show you the problem on the one hand of the sensual realm, but they also then imply the solution, yeah, at the same time. I didn't really look at the solution in all cases. I should have kind of looked more at the other side in all of these cases, because the other side is also important. So you see the problem, and then you see the solution. You see why it doesn't work, and then you see how it might be different if you think about the world in the right way. So I would recommend you to try to think a little bit about these similes, yeah? Because they, if you understand what they are about, you start to understand the limitations of samsara. You can imagine that, you know, if you everything in life is borrowed goods, yeah, and then if you spend your whole life just kind of building up borrowed goods, then what do you feel like on your deathbed? It feels like you have wasted your life, yeah? You have built up all of this goods, all of this friendship, all of your social status, you have built up your ego, all these possessions, whatever it is, all of these things, you've made a really nice body. Yeah, you have been running and jogging and kind of weightlifting to kind of make your body just right. And then it ends up in a small pile of ash. Yeah, that's what happens from the crematorium. Yeah, how much effort should we put into the things of this world when we know we're going to have to give it up at the end of the day? That's what you start to realize. And those people, those in the world who spend everything, all they do is looking after the things that belong to this world. When they come to the deathbed, how do they feel? They feel terrible. Everything they have done has to be given up. They can't take anything with them. Everything stops right here. And then you feel a sense of emptiness. You feel a sense of purposelessness. You feel a sense that you have wasted your life. You had an opportunity to do something good that you can take with you after you exit from this life. You didn't take the opportunity. Instead, you invested everything in things that eventually are going to have to go. Yeah, once you get this, it starts to become kind of concerning. And you also now start to understand why the idea of rebirth really matters. Yeah, because then, of course, the long term looks very different from what otherwise is how we should invest our time, whatever, if we only believe in a single lifetime and everything stops after that. The idea of rebirth expands the horizon out. It makes you think about life in a different way. So this is what the idea behind this kind of reflection is about. It starts, again, it changes your values, makes you look at life in a different way, and then it affects quite strongly how you live your life. Anyway, so there you are. Make out of that what you, as you see fit. That is all for now. We'll come back again this evening and continue with the last Q&A this evening. So see you back again at around 6 o'clock.